Hey everybody, this is Writers in the Round. My guests on this evening's programme are three members of the English Department faculty here at UTC. Dr. Richard Jackson is a member of the faculty in the Creative Writing Department. He also coordinates the biannual Meacham Writers Workshop. Dr. Thomas Balazs is also a member of the Creative Writing Department faculty, and Dr. Alex Quinlan is a visiting lecturer in the English Department. They all came by to talk about their writing. Dr. Jackson and Dr. Quinlan are both poets. Dr. Balazs is a short story writer and more recently a novelist. But Dr. Balazs is also the organiser of the inaugural Roses and Wine, a gathering scheduled for tomorrow afternoon, Thursday, February 13th at 5 o'clock on the second floor of the Tall Grey Building in the Tom Ware Lounge. The Tall Grey Building is at 540 Macaulay Avenue. Roses and Wine, as you might guess, the wine, incidentally, is wine with an H, is an opportunity for both the faculty and students to share their writing about Valentine's Day, both pro and con. Dr. Jackson, as I said, organises the biannual Meacham Writers Workshop. The next workshop is scheduled for March 19th through the 21st. And in a sense, this programme is a sort of Meacham in miniature. This is a quote from an essay that Richard wrote called Language-Driven Poetry. It's subtitled An Introduction to the Principle of Generating Poems, and it goes on to say that that principle aims to demonstrate that the imaginative vision possible to us through poetry exists not in the dressing up of ideas, feelings, or events that the poet tries to find words to describe, but in its exploration of language, not merely a record, but a gesture always trying to escape itself, escape our human condition towards something universal. I thought that was a great way of talking about at least one approach to writing, and I was wondering if you'd all care to comment on that. Richard first, obviously, since you said it.
Yeah, well, for me, the key word in there is gesture, in that I think what a poem tries to do, any kind of literature tries to do, is give you a sense of the gestures that the writer's making. It's kind of like getting into the writer's mind. For me, that's the most important thing. When I go to read a story or a poem, it's not because I want to get some philosophy or theology out of it. I can go to a philosophy or theology book and get it more concisely. But I want to get the experience of it, which is like when you're listening to someone talk, you know, you hear the words, but it's the gestures that always give you the kind of unspoken, the kind of mystery, the what's beyond just the simple words. And I think that's what any kind of good literature will do, yeah.
After I read that quote from you, Richard, I read several of your poems, and what struck me immediately about the way they were written is the way you use adjectives, especially in a... It's an adjective that it would never occur to you to use, in, at least not to me, which I guess isn't necessarily saying very much, in that setting. Water prowling around the lingering rocks, a snail crawling out of its shell, the drizzle of light. You know, it's such a great use of language because it's, as you say, it expresses an idea, but it expresses it in a way that makes you first, I think about the language, but then think about what that language means. And then having done that, you have got an image in your mind that may never have occurred to you before that.
Yeah, you want to see things, I think, in a new way, in a different way. And, you know, I do spend a lot of time in the woods, and you see one thing and it echoes against another thing, and sometimes the adjectives for one thing start to get applied to something else, and pretty soon you have a kind of different perception of something. And that's what I meant about, you know, seeing how somebody's mind works in a poem or a story.
So I guess that there are two essential reasons that we are gathered here. The first is to talk about
Roses and Wine, isn't it?
Roses and Wine.
Valentine's Day Poetry Jam, Roses and Wine, as in W-H-I-N-E.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's important to know that there's an H in that wine.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And this was Tom's idea.
So it came out of, we were looking for some sort of event to introduce particularly the creative writing part of the English department to new students, but also to have fun with our existing students, majors, English majors and creative writing majors. And I had done something, the actual idea for doing a Valentine's Day thing was Sybil Baker's, but it had reminded me of something that I had done in a previous life at a previous university, which was like an anti-Valentine's Day poetry event. And at that was really oriented around making fun of Valentine's Day, and we had a great time. And the award that I gave out was a dinner for one at a local restaurant. So I brought that up in response to the idea of a Valentine's Day event, and we all thought that was a good idea, but that we'd broaden it out so it didn't just have to be anti-Valentine's Day, that it would include all the aspects of Valentine's Day, love, lust, and also anti-love. So that's what we're going to be doing, and it's going to be a fun event where we'll hear poetry from, you know, the writers in our department as well as the students, and we'll have one of the poets in our department will play some sort of word games, poetry games to get students also writing there. And then we'll have some sort of competition with prizes, including the dinner for one.
Which is a thing.
Yeah.
Did you know that? SAD? Single Awareness Day? It's for people who on Valentine's Day are not attached.
Well, that's good. I'm
and
happy
they eat
that
alone.
We're
who knew?
We're involved in that.
Although at the same time, you know, it's almost... It's one of those obvious ideas that until somebody says it, you think, somebody should say this.
Yeah,
not everybody, on Valentine's Day.
Feelings about Valentine's Day, because if you're in a relationship, there's a lot of pressure to do something special for Valentine's Day, and it can almost never live up to that pressure. It's sort of like New Year's Eve, where you're supposed to have a great time. Like, you go into New Year's Eve thinking, I've got to have a great time. I've got to get, like drink a lot and kiss somebody at New Year's Eve at, like, midnight. And if I don't have, like, this amazing party, this amazing time, then my New Year's Eve is crap, you know? So, and by that standards, it never works out. So, Valentine's Day, that's how I feel about it. If you're in a relationship, and if you're not in a relationship, well, then it's just a reminder that you're not in a relationship. And you think everybody's having this great day, and, you know.
You're left out.
And you're left out, So it's a good time, you know, to indulge some creative bitterness.
I'm with you entirely on the notion of New Year's. It's always seemed to me to be a holiday in search of a holiday.
Absolutely.
And I never quite understood what exactly we're supposed to do, and I don't think most people do. And so they just drink enough so they stop thinking about it.
Exactly.
Speaking of which, apparently one of the foundations for Valentine's was, I think it's pronounced Lupercalia, and that was a Roman festival, and apparently it lasted for 2 days, 3 days in fact, and was relatively debauched. Men sacrificed a goat and a dog and then whipped women with the hides of the animals they'd just shorn. And apparently the young women were willing to let them do this because they thought it would make them fertile. And then the Catholic Church comes along and tries to wrap it in,
either. You know, they probably went into that holiday thinking they're going to have a great old time. They're going to be whipping some goats.
Exactly.
And debauching. And then afterwards they were like, you know, it wasn't really as debauchful as I'd hoped. And I kind of, you know, maybe next year.
It's hard to imagine how it could be any less debauchful, really. Yeah, I mean, the notion apparently was that everybody sheds their clothes, drinks a lot, not to put too fine a point on it, they couple for the duration of the festival or for that point
on. I wonder what the women really thought of that afterwards.
Yes, you have to wonder. Yeah. Well, you know, given their
the
social situation at the time, you know.
Whipping pot might have been a little bit of a downer.
What did the goats think about it?
We hope people have a lot of fun at this. And it's of course not just for English majors. The whole university.
Everybody can relate to this.
I think it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun. And
are you going to be the voice of anti-Valentine, Tom?
I might. I don't know. I have one anti-Valentine's Day.
You care to share it with
me? Me too.
Well, I'll just tell you the title. It's She Walks in Beauty Like a Mite.
I have one that I actually brought.
Please do.
I wrote this, Richard,
that somebody said of you in a review, actually, he is a romantic documenting the transience of love.
Well, I wrote this basically in a class the other night. We were messing around. Michael was in the the class. And so it's called Love Underground. And by the way, when you write a poem like this, you absolutely need to talk to your significant other and assure them that it's not about them. So, Love Underground. Loving you was like being trapped in an abandoned mineshaft about to collapse, the methane starting to build with no warning canary, the coal dust filling my lungs and the oxygen masks rotting, the lanterns flickering out, the rescue teams abandoned, the entrance boarded up, and the coal cart run off the tracks, carrying its last jagged lump in the rough shape of your heart.
See, but that's really good poetry, good anti-vampire poetry. Actually, might have to pull mine out.
But it will never exist.
I wish you would, Tom. And let me introduce one of our other guests is Alex Quinlan. And actually, I share several things with you, Alex. It wasn't all boys, but it was a Catholic school. So I've been through that experience. But I also could relate to you talking about your entree to poetry was through the blues.
You have done your research, haven't you? Yeah, and actually, I brought a poem today that is, it's not quite so cynical about love, maybe, as Rick's, although I just did pull up one that might be able to match his for heartbrokenness. But yeah, music has always been something that I draw a lot of inspiration from, and I think that's why, I think among all of the literary arts, poetry's always been the one that can win my heart, because it more so than fiction or drama or the personal essay, memoir, other forms of literature, oftentimes poetry puts the music of language at its heart. And I think, when Rick was talking about, a language-based poetry, I think that's one of the really radical propositions at the heart of a poem, is what the poet Matthew Zapruder has said, that over the course of time, human understanding, what we call wisdom, actually gets encoded in language, and it's passed down to us that way. And the closer our relationship is with our language, the better access we have to that vast store of accumulated human understanding and wisdom. And so often, through this kind of alchemical majesty, the way that it's expressed in poetry is through sound, just as in music. So, yeah.
So you are as interested in language that's a conversation I've had recently with a number of particularly young poets. Mm-hmm. Who often think of poetry as something that is that you present, not that's on the page, but that, that you read it to an audience. You're one step away from a rapper, really.
There's a lot of connections, mm-hmm. right there. And you look at one of the earliest poets in the lyric tradition, Sappho, right? Those poems were written to be performed. Oftentimes in elaborate settings with dancers and certainly musical accompaniment, hence the term lyric, right? With the accompaniment of the lyre.
Yeah, there was the improvisatori in the Renaissance who would have to basically sing for the supper.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the shops in medieval England, right? Who would go around reciting scraps of Beowulf for their food, right? And their drink as well. Yeah.
It gives a whole new meaning to writing, doesn't it? I think it was Tom who was saying that you can spend your time writing, and when you are writing, find yourself asking, does anybody care?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, they certainly did if it meant you weren't going to get to eat supper, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Better find a way to make them care.
Well, we have a finite time on the earth. Walter Pater said, we have a limited number of impulses that we are available to us, and we should burn with a hard fire, like gem-like flame. And he believed that writing literature offered to you the most intense, meaningful experiences to make use of the limited amount of pulses we get in life. So, yeah, and I think, you get to an age where, like you realize you're not going to be able to read everything you want to read. Like you're gonna have to make choices. And every piece of writing demands of the reader that they give to that piece of writing some part of themselves, some part of their life to the time. So you have to make it worthwhile. You have to make it worth somebody's time that they should give you that precious 10 minutes of their life that they could be spending reading Sophocles, for example. You know, I was just actually teaching James Joyce in my Reading Like a Writer course, and we were looking at, my student quoted H.G. Wells on Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. And H.G. Wells said something like, who is this guy, James Joyce, that he should expect that I'm going to devote any, like, the limited hours that I have to life to this particular book that is like incomprehensible and only expresses his particular foibles and quirks. And I mean, I think that's, you know, that's not an unfair critique to some extent, because you have to earn a bit of life that you're asking, you know, the reader to share with you.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, maybe one way of summing that up is to say that it's okay for your art, for your poetry, for your writing to be personal, but if it's going to have a broader impact, it can't be merely private. It has to mean something, right, beyond your own catharsis.
Michael, I don't mean to leave you out of the conversation.
Oh,
please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Michael Beard.
And you are welcome here, Michael, and please just jump in. The last part of that quote from Richard was escape our human condition towards something universal. I thought that was a really nice way of saying that.
Absolutely.
You know, that we have this tendency to think and to, I guess, write as a result, as if it was a kind of a personal expression. But it isn't really, is it? It may be expressed through the personal, but if that's all it is, as Tom is suggesting with Finnegan's Wake with James Joyce, which incidentally, Tom, I couldn't make any sense of James Joyce until I heard Joan Baez reading it. And she read it in this kind of, it kind of had a tripping rhythm to it. All of a sudden it made sense. This is the way Irish people talk.
Right.
And so it's transliterated, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, Joyce did say about Finnegan's Wake, it's not so hard, you just have to read it out loud.
Yeah.
But that's not exactly been my experience. I don't know, maybe I just don't have the right way to read it. I always tell the story that when I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, I was in the Finnegan's Wake workshop for a little bit. And, you know, we would have people from psychology, mathematics, comparative literature. We would spend 2 hours reading 2 pages of Finnegan's Wake. And afterwards, we couldn't really say with certainty what it was about. You know?
Really?
So
it defied that kind of analysis.
Yeah, but right? I mean, I think, but that's why I think really, to be honest, I consider Finnegan's Wake really a poem more than a novel. And I mean, for me, so the whole issue of language-driven art is really, it's a poetic concept. For me, in fiction, is story-driven. And so I think Joyce's later works, his earlier works, I think, were story-driven. Dubliners, Portrait of the Artist, even Ulysses, parts at least.
Yeah.
But Finnegan's Wake is a completely language-driven work of art. I don't really, well, I haven't read the whole thing, so I can't say what the story is, but I've read summaries of it. There's not a whole lot of story there. It's imagistic, and there's not much in the way of narrative movement. So I do think that is a difference between fiction and poetry. Though they can, you know, they can come together in prose poems or in certain kinds of novels that are very lyrical, some of Virginia Woolf's works, for example. But, you know, in my classes, I tend to emphasize story, actually.
Yeah, that whole sense of the audience, you know, that both of you were talking about is so, you know, once you write something down, it's not just for you.
Right.
Once it's on paper, and which is what we try to do in classes, in a workshop. So a student will read their work, and sometimes no one understands exactly what's going on in it, or they miss certain parts. There's a backstory that's needed. And so that sense of when you write something, how the other people are going to take it in the class is a beginning way of seeing how, if you were going to publish something, a novel or a book of poems, how that's going to be taken also, too. So it's kind of a way to teach you how to see what you're writing from a reader's point of view and not just your point of view.
Right, yeah, I think of it as like a, you know, the equivalent would be like a dress rehearsal or a test screening of a movie, right, where you still have the chance to go back based on what the audience thinks and, you know, change the ending if you want, right? You know, give the people what they want, right? That's the name of the game on some level, mm-hmm. after all, because you have to keep them with you. You have to have their attention or you have nothing, so.
So it's a balance, huh?
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, my guests, Alex Quinlan, Tom Balazs, Richard Jackson and Michael Beard are here to really to talk about two things. We're talking about Roses and Wine, which is a celebration, as somebody said, of love, lust, and everything else that goes along with Valentine's Day, and at the same time, an opportunity, if you don't like Valentine's Day, to express that also. It's also to talk about the upcoming Meacham Writers' Workshop, which is twice a year here at the university. It's been here since the 1980s. In fact, it was Richard Jackson who first suggested that there be a writer's workshop here. And the beauty of the workshop, two things, I suppose, really. The essence is that it's free. Anybody, whether they be a skilled writer or somebody who is just beginning to put pen to paper, can come together at no cost and talk to people who are really very good and have a reputation that goes way beyond the workshop and is national and in many cases international. And yet, despite that kind of standing, they're available to you to have a beer or a cup of coffee or eat lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
And we talk really like this.
Emphasize the informality of it. And we've had writers come from all over the country, all over the world, really. We've had people from Israel, from Poland, Hungary, Serbia, Slovenia, Italy.
All of which
UK.
Reflects your
yeah,
travels.
Yeah.
Don't you? You take students abroad every summer,
don't
you?
Yes, we do that too. Every spring, usually, almost every spring. We went to Iceland just in this past, well, we usually go to Italy and Slovenia and Czech Republic. The Meacham Workshop has had an incredible influence on our students. I mean, I think it contributes to the creative writing program as a whole amazingly, in the sense that I think 100% of the poetry students, at least, have applied to MFA programs, have gotten fellowships and assistantships over the years. Over 40 have published almost 80 books, including Khaled Matawa, who won one of those MacArthur Awards, Bradley Paul, who's written for Better Call Saul, Josh Mensch runs a magazine in the Czech Republic. Students have done amazing things like that. So, you know, it's really proud. In many ways, students have exceeded us, I think, which is actually a kind of a nice feeling.
Well, that's the ideal, I guess, right? Yeah. But the impression I have is that philosophy that is the foundation of the workshop is something that you take with you. And when you travel abroad, you find yourself in conversation with people who might otherwise never have the opportunity to talk to. And then, as you say, you have all these writers from around the globe, and that's because you've met them already and invited mm-hmm. them to come back in some cases.
Yeah, and when students go abroad, they get an incredibly different understanding of what it means to be a writer. They respect it in ways that, well, here's an example. We went to Slovenia once, and we had two van loads of students. And so when I went in to sign all the papers, gentleman came out and said, well, who are all these people? I said, well, they're young writers who have come to learn a little of the language, meet some of the writers, get a sense of the history. And he said, really? And ran back and came back with a bottle of wine for each. I've tried that at Avis and it doesn't work. But it's an incredible sense. But, you know, actually, Chris Wharton is the one who's doing a lot of the nitty-gritty for the Meacham. She might be able to add a few things.
So I should probably talk a little bit about who we'll have at the Meacham this spring. The dates are March 19th to the 21st, and we'll hold four readings that will be a combination of our visiting authors, who I'll speak about in a minute, and then also our UTC faculty. We have such a talented group of local writers, I'm always impressed when I get to hear them read. So it's not to be missed. With the Meacham, in addition to the readings, we also have small group workshops that the visiting authors hold with the students. And so students can submit work, and then they're put into these small groups, and they get some personalized work and some personalized guidelines. And then there's also a Q&A after our final reading. So it's a good variety of venues for people to come to.
Yeah, let me just reiterate what you just said. This is an opportunity to sit down in a small group with frequently an author who has an international reputation, who's probably won all kinds of awards, who may have been writing for much of his life or her life. And you get to sit down with a small group of people and just chat and share your work and have this person look at your work and critique it.
It's true.
How many opportunities do you get to do something like that?
You don't get many, and we do have a great group. I'd like to just tell you a little bit about our visitors. We'll have four poets. Tina Moselle Brazel, she's out of Birmingham, and she's been awarded the Philip Levine Prize for Poetry. Her two most recent books are Known by Salt from Anhinga Press and Rooted by Thirst from Pork Belly Press. Danielle Hansen is a UTC graduate. She'll be coming up from Atlanta. She has, her two most recent collections are Fraying the Edge of Sky and Ambushing Water, and her work is quite lovely. She reads beautifully. She was a finalist for the 2018 Georgia Author of the Year Award. Dr. Donna Coffey Little is a professor of English at Reinhardt University and a founder of Reinhardt's Etowah Valley Low Residency MFA. Her chapbook, Fire Street, was published in 2012, and she's won numerous awards as well. The final poet is Sandra Meek, who will be coming up from Berry College in Rome, Georgia. She has six books of poems, including Still and An Ecology of Elsewhere. She's a recipient of the NEA Fellowship in Poetry. We'll also have Dana Shaven, who is a local creative nonfiction or essayist. She's fantastic. Her memoir is called The Body Tourist. It came out in 2014. And she's been widely published in some diverse publications, Oxford American, Psychology Today, The Sun. She is also featured in the Chattanooga Times Free Press, so you can see her work there. Finally, last but not least, we have Katie Yoakum, who is a fiction writer. She'll be coming in from Louisville, and she has a debut novel that she'll be reading from, Three Ways to Disappear. She is an Al Smith Fellowship Award recipient. So we're quite excited to have this group of writers.
I can see why.
Yes.
So what's your role exactly, Chris?
Well, Rick and I talk a lot. We plan a lot.
How long does that take? When do you start doing that?
Well, because we have a Meacham in the spring and in the fall, we're always working on it.
Well, that's what I figured, yeah.
Kind of talking about who to invite, who to reach out to. We talk to the faculty and the creative writing group and ask them for recommendations.
And most of these writers, they know the reputation of our undergraduate program. In fact, one of our visiting writers once called the Stanley Plumlee from the University of Maryland said that UTC's undergraduate program was really a graduate program disguised as an undergraduate program.
What was your thinking when you first suggested this workshop?
This was back in 86. Jean Meacham had, we had helped her, a lot of the students wanted to be involved in a previous workshop we had, which was a Charlie Scott workshop. The students really helped her so much, and I was helping her do some things at the university because her hands couldn't handle this before computers and all that. And so she decided she wanted to make a professorship. And I suggested, well, let's not make it a professorship. Let's make it something for the students, for visiting writers to come in. And not totally altruistic, because it makes my job easier when a lot of people come in and help the students along. So that's really how it began.
Yeah. And what was the response when you first started putting out invitations?
It was great. Our first one, we had Marvin Bell, Dara Wire, Alan Wire, and Who was the last person? I'll think of it later. We just had four people come. The writing program was a lot smaller. And in fact, it was just myself and another fiction writer. And then it grew and grew. And we've had writers come for a fraction of what they usually would demand, simply because they know the program.
That's what I'm getting. That right from the outset, there must have been a reputation they were responding to. Right? Because this is an unknown festival. Nobody knows anything about it, and yet people agree to do it. On top of which, you present this as a free festival. That's because of the funding that you got from Jean Meacham and her husband.
Yeah, it's actually the only free festival in the country.
That's what I heard, yeah. And that comes from Jean Meacham. She was a teacher here at UTC.
Yes, yeah, she was.
And her husband, I can't remember his name.
Judge, yeah.
And he helps you fund this. Is that funding still ongoing?
Yes, it's it was put in, and it keeps gaining money every year.
Right, so it's got like a foundation that you draw on. It's almost 40 years now that you've been doing this.
Yeah, really. I hadn't thought about that. it's had a great effect on our students, as I was saying. They've gone off, and some of them teach at different places. Some of them work in editing jobs, just all kinds of things. So it's a delight to see the effects.
It strikes me that, to go back to that notion of the writer, and of course, it's, as anybody knows who's tried it, it's a solitary profession. And there's always perhaps this voice in the back of your head when you're writing and you're sitting there by yourself. Is anybody ever going to read this? Does anybody even care? And it seems that at least one of the things that comes out of this workshop is there's a lot of people care about this. And there's a lot of people who not only care about it and spend their lives working at it, but they're willing to come and talk to you about it, even though you've just started and you're a newbie in the whole circle.
Yeah, there's an old friend of mine, a writer who used to come here and died in 1997, William Matthews, said that somewhere in the back of your head when you're writing, you have to be able to say, you are the best damn writer and that nobody else can do what you're doing.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Even though that kind of hubris can derail you too.
But once you see what you've written, that goes away very quickly.
Well, as I said, another of our guests is Tom Balazs. And Tom is uniquely qualified to talk about one of the hobgoblins for any writer, and that's procrastination.
how did you get to that? procrastination is a hobgoblin. It comes out of fear, basically, and that's the only reason I think that writers procrastinate is because they're afraid that they won't produce something of quality, you have to think on the one hand, it's very paradoxical. You have to think on the one hand that you're going to produce something that people are going to want to read, and that they're going to want to read instead of something else that they could read, either another contemporary writer or a classical writer of some kind, or just watch TV or something. So I've gotten advice about procrastination and how to avoid it or how to deal with it. One of the things that I do when I'm struggling with procrastination is, well, one, I break it into small increments. Like I actually use, sometimes there's an app, it's called Tomato Timer or something. You break it into 20-minute intervals and with 5-minute breaks and a 20-minute break every hour. And it's really works quite well. And it's like you get writing and that bell comes at 20 minutes. You're like, 20 minutes? Really? I thought it was 5 minutes. And somehow it takes away some of the pressure. Another kind of very weird thing that I picked up from somebody a while back, but I think it works for me, is as writers, we have a lot of baggage that we bring to our writing. That is to say, a lot of things that we want from our writing. We want to be famous. We want to get attention. We want to make up for the fact that our parents didn't give us enough attention. Okay, we want to impress people. We want to make money. We want to live forever, whatever. All those things, so they're kind of baggage, you know? So a writer suggested to me once, I mean, this is something he suggests to a lot of people, he was a writing coach, you get yourself some toy trains, okay? like an engine with like a couple of cabooses, okay? And the cabooses are like the baggage. Like before you start writing, you get your toy trains and you disconnect the baggage from the caboose. and you say, I don't care. I'm not writing to be famous. I'm not writing to impress anybody. I'm not writing, you know, to get tenure or to do whatever it is, you know, all the baggagey kinds of things. I'm just writing to write. And whatever comes of it, comes of it. And I don't, you know, and I find these little tricks to be helpful. And if you can... You can take away some of the anxiety out of writing, then you'll be less likely to procrastinate.
I'm interested in hearing if Michael feels that kind of anxiety as a student.
Yeah, definitely do. A little less so with poetry, I think, just because I enjoy poetry a little bit more than fiction or creative nonfiction. But
how long have you been writing poetry, Michael?
I actually started pretty late. I was a late bloomer. I started senior year of high school whenever I started writing poetry.
Not around Valentine's Day, was it?
No, no, not around Valentine's Day.
Well, to respond to what you just said, for me, writing poetry is about as... Well, it's akin to lifting a 100-weight barbell. I look at it and I think, I can do that. But the minute I try it, not even close. You know, I find writing poetry to be incredibly difficult. It seems to me that while you know, all writing, as somebody said, is easy, you just open a vein and stick the pen in. But there's something about poetry that seems to me that's writing and then distilling what you've written into the essence of the expression. Yeah. And I get stuck somewhere there,
yeah,
between that one step and the next step. You know,
I'm a very slow writer. I have these assignments every week. I have to write 2 poems because I'm taking 2 poetry workshops. And I find myself struggling to even get one in just because I like obsess over poems. But I think that all of that, what you said, contributes to that sort of slow pace. And you just kind of have to like put it out there.
No, no. So how do you start writing a poem? What's the first thing you do?
Usually I think, or I start a poem with an image or with an idea that I want to try and convey. I don't really start with a title or a beginning or ending that I have in mind. The poem just sort of explores itself, I think.
Can you give us an example? Do you have any of your poetry with you?
Do I have any of my poetry with me? This poem is called Suspension. In this little dark age we find ourselves in, a bird feeder hangs from nothing and is filled with memories lost from timeless beings once living. Dusk wraps fine cloth around the hollow heads of men who cannot think. Like drooping saplings incapable of growth, dawn entraps my legs in thin wire mesh. The lighthouse mourns its more useful years, when times of rain were longer and fog slept on the ocean's barren skin. A halved papaya dangles, dropping seeds above a plant pot that almost catches them. I see other empty storaging too, glass vase, clay cup, porcelain bowl, all in a made line as if to suggest something about our vacancy. It's just a slow process, but you have to stick with it.
Was it you, Alex, who said that you started a poem with the last line and then worked backwards?
That's certainly something that I've done in the past, yeah.
Michael was just saying brought that to mind.
Well, and, you know, you begin, you know, I think a lot of what Michael was saying, resonates with me. Because, you know, often it is, for me, the thing that sparks a poem will be, sometimes it's just a phrase and the sort of the music of a phrase. In the case of this poem I've got right here, sort of anti-love poem called Asylum, right? Sort of based on the, a couple of meanings that are contained within that word, right? You know, an asylum is a place of refuge, right? A place of safety. But it's also where, you know, what they used to call the place they put you if you were, you know,
that's interesting. I never thought about that. Yeah.
Gone over the moon, yeah. Right? You know, yeah. So something like that, it's like a little grain, right? That gets lodged in an oyster, right? And then, you give it enough time, and there's something beautiful that can come of it.
Let's see what came of it.
Yeah. So yeah. So here's this poem, and it has nothing. It has no autobiographical quality, right? Rick, your disclaimer from earlier applies here. So it's called Asylum. My love wanders the linoleum halls of my scabby little heart mind like an insomniac cricket in a dark jar, barefoot in her blue-green gown, until the night nurse sends her back to the silence of the flimsy cot where she can hear the smallest hairs stiffen on her neck as soon as she thinks of the ship, the wreck, and the porthole that opened in the back of the head. What escaped through it? Not the mess. There is a name for the mess. But what swarmed out after. My air vents hush and my generators hum while she smashes her cheeks against the cold slashes barring the window until they boss her face, leave dark marks, and she tells herself it's the same as breathing the air outside. And she lies between my block walls, listening to the iron key ring clank at the hip of the orderly's crisp white slacks. The floors are immaculate. Pill cups neat in their trays and empty. Through a dripping gutter, I tap out love notes in dull morse. My love thrums her thumb on a bedspring and looks through the portal in the back of my mind, far from the brutal sea.
That's a very realistic love poem, I think.
Yeah, right. It's a safe little cage, right?
Now I'm feeling bad about reading my anti-love poem. I have one to make up for that.
Please do. Well, let me first tell everybody that these anti-Valentines are part of a presentation called Roses and Wine by the English Department. It'll be on Thursday, 5 o'clock, is that correct?
5 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah. On Thursday evening, and it's as the Meacham, it's open to everybody, and it's an opportunity to either vent or celebrate Valentine's.
Exactly. You take all comers.
What's your position on this, Alex? You read the anti-Valentine, but how do you feel about the day itself?
I'm a hopeless romantic, you know, Richard. I can't do anything about it. I'm a bit of a Gen Xer. I'm kind of right on the cusp of, you know, between Gen X and the millennial generation, sort of dating myself, right? So, you know, my native habitat is cynicism, right? I tried that on and it just didn't fit right, you know. So, I've in my own personal life, my wife and I have been together for pretty much our whole life, actually more than half of our lives at this point. We're high school sweethearts. We've been married since we were 24 years old. We have two kids. And so, yeah, we get a little sappy around Valentine's Day. And, I do the roses and the wine and not the whining, right, but the actual, right, the fruit of the vine. And, I like to partake in that. But, you know, as you can see, right, you know, I have a sympathy for maybe the other side of the coin as well.
What about on Thursday? What are you planning to do for that?
Well, on Thursday, I plan to be at the event in the Tom Ware Reading Room, right, and having a good time with that. And then, you know, afterwards, I think, you know, my wife and I'll probably.
Are you going to be sharing some of your poems with people?
Yeah. It looks like I'm on the docket for that.
So you're reading romantic stuff or not?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about reading this poem you mentioned earlier about the influence of music on my poetry, and so there's a poem I actually brought here that I think I'm probably going to read on Thursday called Joy in Everything, which takes its line from B.B. King's song, Sweet Little Angel, and kind of explores the nature of love, the nature of joy, right? Actually coming out of a moment when I was teaching literature last semester, and we were starting the poetry unit. And a lot of what you were saying about the 100-pound barbell, right? I think my students can relate to that, you know. And I tell them, oh, it's not that hard. And I'm balancing it on my finger, and they're like, oh, it's impossible. We could never lift it.
Yeah, look at me. It's easy.
And the thing is, we've all been there. I remember being completely intimidated and blown away, right, by Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning when I was a freshman in college. It made zero sense to me. And then I went in and sort of, you know, had it unlocked by this wonderful professor of mine. And it was actually Sandra Meek, who's going to be one of the visiting.
Oh, I didn't know.
One of the visiting poets at Meacham. She was my first teacher in poetry. So,
Richard wanted to share one of his poems, which is saying something. Richard has written, I think, at this point, 10 books of poetry. Is that true? Oh,
far 15, more than actually.
That, yeah. 15. Okay, yeah. So you are uniquely qualified then to address this whole notion of how did you start as a poet? And did you ever have a time when it seemed to you to be so daunting you weren't even sure you could ever master it?
I started off in engineering school in New York City, and I was there a couple of weeks and realized I even didn't want to do that. So I started to hang out in Washington Square down the Village and learned to play the guitar, was in a couple little groups and stuff. I could play okay, but not enough to really do anything beyond a bar. And my voice wasn't very good. I was just the instrumentalist. but I did have the words. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically how I got into poetry, basically.
And poetry was, that was perhaps one of the first times in sort of popular culture that poetry had standing in maybe a generation, huh?
Yeah, I think because a lot of people thought of, probably my earliest influence was actually Bob Dylan. Mm. And, you know, the backs of those old albums had his stuff as a poem. And mine looked like that, all small letters, skinny little lines, and pretty awful. But anyways, this poem I wrote.
So at what point did they get better?
Well, have they?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
People would argue. The thing about this poem that I like is...
All right, well, let me frame that question differently. At what point did you feel, I can do this?
I think when I went to the Breedlove Writers' Conference, as soon as I got out of undergraduate school, and I had a mentor there, his name is Miller Williams, who's actually the dad of Lucinda. Mm-hmm. And he looked at one of my poems and he said, you know, you got a lot of nice images in here. You should try writing a poem. And I understood immediately what he meant. That, you know, I was just sort of like taking little pictures and not pulling it together. But it also gave me some sense that, yeah, now I could do something like that.
Did he give you some sort of key? Is that what you mean?
No, he just said, you know,
just
go
by saying
it,
that?
Pick up a pencil and start writing. And
there's
he
no
made
substitute.
Everything. Yeah.
There's no substitute for that.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, for a poet, you know, to be able to create an image that transports the reader is the gateway.
Agreed.
That's the gateway.
Yeah.
So in a way, he's telling you have a long way to go with that. Right, you should write a poem, but he's letting you know that
the foundation
the first
is there,
step.
Right?
He told me something that I thought was really good, and it took away that sense of the barbells. And he said, you know, the poem writing poems isn't too hard. It's just like prose, except it just doesn't go over to the end of the page. And I've used that a lot, and in some ways, there's a certain kind of truth to
Absolutely.
So I think at that point, and that was... just before I went into graduate school, that I felt that, well, maybe I could do this.
Well, please share the poem with us.
This one I wrote actually for my wife, and it was written around Valentine's Day. There's a funny story behind it. I read it to a friend before it was in this book in New York City. He was visiting from Slovenia with his wife, and so I read this to him, to both of them, and Metka turned to her husband said, Tomas, you have to write me one of these. So it's called Sonata of Love's History. And that trick in it was to write a longish, well, one-page poem that's all one sentence and have it still be grammatical. Before I could arrive at this moment when the earth wakes inside you, when the night is still tangled in your hair, before I could see how the moonlight melts on your breast as you lay beside me, before you opened the hands of your soul, at this moment that is so sudden, so unexpected, I can only imagine how the softness of your voice must be enough to stop the insects for miles. And I begin to understand how the way you open your eyes to the morning must be enough to change the orbits of planets. So it must have been necessary for me, if I've really arrived at this moment alive, to have lived a life where only my shadow planted the garden Only my shadow walked through the market, fingered the keys nervously, drove the car too fast. And it must be the same shadow that curls up in the corner of the room or is hung in the closet, collecting moss. And it must have taken centuries of bones turning to light, of rivers changing course, of battles won or lost, of a farmer planting one crop or another that failed or not. One atom hitting another atom by chance, and through all this, a single string of time survived volcanoes, lightning strikes, car wrecks, floods, invasions, to lead to this moment, abandoned randomly to us, this singular moment that is part of time's litter, or maybe its architecture. Because now, in this moment, which is so wondrous, the way it lies beside you, I either do not exist or the past has never existed. Either my breath is the breath of stars, or I do not breathe as I turn to you. As you breathe my name, my heart, as the net of stars dissolves above us, as you wrap yourself around me like honeysuckle, the moon turning pale because it is so drained by our love. So that before this moment, before you lay beneath me, you must have disguised yourself the way the killdeer you pointed out diverts intruders to save what it loves, pretending a broken wing, giving itself over finally to whatever forces, whatever love, whatever touch, whatever suffering it needs just to say, I am here, I am always here, stroking the wings of your soul.
An image in almost every line. Beautifully done, thank you. Took you a long time to get to where you wanted to go, Tom. You started out wanting to write the great American novel, and you have most recently, I think, written a collection of short stories.
Well, no, that's not so recent. That was back in 2012, I think.
Yeah, that's what I get for using the internet as a resource.
Yeah. I've recently completed a novel that I'm shopping around.
Oh, you have?
Yeah,
oh,
it took
congratulations.
Me a long time to write. It'll be more congratulations when I get it published.
Well, I think sometimes there's the assumption that a short story is easier to write than a novel. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do. And it's also quite different. You know, when I went to graduate school for my MFA, I wanted to be a novelist, but my thought was that I would start off with the short stories and acquire the skills and then move on to write the novel, kind of imagining like that's like, to use the weights analogy, that's like working out with some 25-pound barbells and building up your muscles so you can pick up the 100-pound barbell. But the problem is it's a different exercise, and it's a different genre. There are, of course, a lot of things in common between the short story and the novel, you know, dialogue and setting and voice and all that sort of thing, but quite different. And so it took me a long time to get on my feet with the novel that I've just finished, and there were a lot of stops and starts, and before that there was a novel that I started and stopped, and so it was, you know, it's been a while. I started properly writing that novel in 2012, and I finished it, you know, maybe last year. It's very, you know, it's an ambitious novel, so that's part of it. But I don't know what the proper training is for writing a novel. You just have to do it.
Well, it strikes me that short story writing has in common with poetry that distillation idea.
Yeah, short stories do have, in some ways, more to do with poetry than with novel writing, because they are based on economy of words. And you don't get to meander. You know, novels can be very leisurely and digressive, and short stories have to be more streamlined and get more to the point. And you have to think more about every word. You know, you don't, for example, I mean, I've written short stories up to 10,000 words, but really if you want to publish a story, you're better off keeping it to 5,000 words. So you really need, or less, you know, maybe 3,500. So you really have to think about everything that goes in there and whether it belongs to be in there. And of course you have to do that with a novel, but I think in a different way. I do think short stories. And of course, like most poetry, I mean, they're meant to be read in one sitting. those novels, you know, is not.
We were talking about experience before, and I remember when Tom first came to be hired, and he was interviewed, and he read a story, which was really daring. and people, their reaction was, wow, that was an experience. And I think that's just, you know, everybody said, okay, let's vote now.
Well, that's good. I guess it was a good choice of a story.
Would you care to give us a taste of your short story writing, Tom?
I could if you want, or I could read my anti-Valentine's Day poem, whichever you...
It's your choice.
Well, I have the anti-Valentine's Day poem.
I know Valentine's is in your mind because you organize this.
I think, you know, with all these poets in the room, I really need to show them how it's done. But
we're taking notes.
Yeah, so this is what happens when a fiction writer tries to pick up the 100-pound bar. it's called, as I said before, She Walks in Beauty Like a Mite. She walks in beauty like a mite that loves to burrow under skin. And she looks best without the light to show her moles and double chin. She clings to me a parasite, and I don't mind her pimply skin. One shade the more of mascara blue had left her mine without a trace of all that Maybelline can do to rectify that pockmarked face, where thoughts sincerely do impress 100 ways to remove a dress. And by that cheek beneath that forehead, so rough, so red, and yet so fancy, she's got a nose like a nuclear warhead, and so it is she makes me antsy when she creeps softly in my bed and speaks to me of Thomas Clancy.
Sounds to me as if Bob Dylan may be an influence on you too, Tom.
I know. I made these guys scared now.
We need to do a book release.
Well, there's a direct line between that one and Shakespeare's My Mistress' Eyes or Nothing Like the Sun, The anti-blazon.
Yeah. I love the Tom Clancy.
So much fun to talk to you.
Thanks,
I'm more than happy to have you come back as guests anytime you care to. And if you want to come back again before the workshop, please do. If you want to bring people in who are going to be here for the workshop also.
Well, that would be a good idea.
That invitation to you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Richard.
That's it for Writers in the Round. My guests are Dr. Thomas Balas, Dr. Richard Jackson, and Dr. Alex Quinlan, along with poetry student Michael Beard and Ms. Chris Wharton. She's the assistant director for the Meacham Writers Workshop, which is set for March 19th through the 21st this spring. And Roses and Wine, a celebration as well as a denigration of Valentine's Day, is set for tomorrow, Thursday, February 13th. At 5 o'clock in the tall grey building on the second floor at 540 Macaulay Avenue. And if you were to go by to Poetry and Wine tomorrow evening, one of the poems you will likely hear is that poem that Dr. Quinlan was talking about, inspired by B.B. King, which we didn't have time for him to share with you. Richard Wynham, thanks so much for listening.